Good morning, and welcome to the Friday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Men are more satisfied by bromances than their romantic relationships, study says. By Amanda McMillan. Young men get more emotional satisfaction out of bromances, close heterosexual friendships with other males, than they do out of romantic relationships with women, according to a small new study published in Men and Masculinities. Intimate male friendships have become more socially acceptable in recent years, say the study authors, and that's largely a good thing. But they caution that the shift could lead to weaker bonds among dating or married couples, or even reduce the likelihood of men and women pairing up at all. The concept of the bromance isn't new. George Washington wrote endearing letters to other men, the study authors note, and Abraham Lincoln shared a bed with a male friend for several years. But close male companionship became more taboo in the second half of the 20th century, say researchers from the University of Winchester in England, due to a rise in homophobic sentiments and changing ideals of what masculinity should look like. In recent years, though, bromances have become cool again, the authors say, thanks in part to high-profile celebrity examples like the Obama-Biden bromance and movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. To find out how much bromances mattered, they surveyed 30 heterosexual men who were second-year college students and had been in a relationship before or were currently. The group was homogeneous, to be sure. Besides all being straight college students, all but one of the men were white and all had a sports-related major. The authors found that every one of them reported having at least one bromantic friend with whom they engaged in no-boundaries behaviors like sharing secrets, expressing love, or sleeping in the same bed at some time or another. 29 out of 30 men said they had cuddled with their bromantic partner. These findings may not apply to men beyond this very specific population, and more research is needed. The authors published their initial findings in May in the journal Sex Roles. In their new analysis, they identify and explore the differences between those men's bromances and their actual romances. Overall, the students reported feeling less judged by their close male friends than by their girlfriends. In the words of one participant, "Tim knows I love listening to Taylor Swift and Beyonce, but I keep that quiet around my girlfriend because she would judge me. I feel like I have to be more manly around her." Men in the study also said it was easier to overcome conflicts and share their emotions, like when a grandparent dies, with their guy friends, and to discuss sensitive health information. 28 out of 30 said they would prefer to discuss personal matters with a bromance than a romance. "If I found a lump on my testicle, I'd talk to my bromance rather than my girlfriend," one interviewee said. When asked to describe the difference between a bromance and a romance, one man noted that there are three factors to consider: sexual attraction, emotional connection, and personality. "A bromance needs the last two," he noted, "while a romance needs two, including sex." There was a conclusive determination from the men we interviewed, the study authors wrote. On balance, they argued that bromantic relationships were more satisfying in their emotional intimacy compared to their heterosexual romances. The fact that men are finally comfortable getting close with one another is a progressive step forward, say the authors, and they suggest that men may benefit greatly from long-term same-sex friendships, especially if they're not comfortable being emotionally intimate with women. But they also express concern about traditional male-female relationships, writing that the rise of the bromances may not altogether be liberating and socially positive for women. Men in the study sometimes referred to their girlfriends using sexist or disdainful language, they wrote, and demonstrated an us-and-them mentality that suggested allegiance to their bros over their romantic partners. The authors even suggest that these changing cultural norms could even have implications for where and how men choose to live, opting to move in with a male roommate rather than a girlfriend, for example, thus delaying or disrupting relationships that could eventually lead to marriage and starting a family. Lovers are temporary, one study participant said during his interview. A bromance can last a lifetime.
Jane Fonda says she is ashamed of her silence on Weinstein allegations. By Lainey Barron. Actress Jane Fonda said she knew of sexual harassment allegations against disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein and is ashamed she did not speak out sooner. I found out about Harvey about a year ago, and I'm ashamed that I didn't say anything right then, the Oscar award winner told CNN Thursday. The 79-year-old star and women's rights activist said that she was never targeted by Weinstein, but that her friend, Pulp Fiction actress Rosanna Arquette, was. I only met Harvey when I was old, and Harvey goes for young, because that's more vulnerable, said Fonda, who declined to speak on Arquette's behalf, leaving it up to her friend to disclose details of the allegations. Arquette is among dozens of actresses who have now publicly accused Weinstein of offenses including harassment, assault, and rape. The actress told The New Yorker that in the early 1990s, Weinstein had tried to get her to massage him, and when she refused, he grabbed her hand and tried to place it on his crotch. He made things very difficult for me for years, she said. Sally Hoffmeister, a spokesperson for Weinstein, responded in a statement that all allegations of non-consensual sex are unequivocally denied by Mr. Weinstein. Fonda said that she did not condemn Weinstein sooner because she didn't feel it was her place, as the incident did not happen to her. She told CNN of her own encounter early in her career with a French director, who said he needed to see what kind of orgasms she had in order to cast her for a role. This harassment goes on all the time, Fonda said. If we all talked and told, then they'd be too afraid to do it, I think, I hope, she added, though she also said that she fears that President Donald Trump's election will have an emboldening effect. Fonda speculated that men may think, our president does it, and he got elected even after people discovered that he was an abuser, so I'm just going to go ahead and do what I want to do. During the 2016 presidential campaign, a video was released of Trump making lewd remarks about women and bragging that he could grope them with impunity. When you're a star, they let you do it, Trump said. Multiple women have accused Trump of sexual harassment or other inappropriate behavior. On Saturday, the president told reporters he was not at all surprised about the allegations against Weinstein.
40% of Americans are obese, and the trend isn't slowing. By Alexandra Sifferlin. Close to 40% of American adults and 19% of young people have obesity, a trend that's remained stubbornly high in the last few years. The latest figures for survey year 2015-2016 come from a new report by the National Center for Health Statistics, and they're not much different than the prior 2013-2014 numbers. In 2013-2014, 37.7% of adults and 17.2% of children had obesity. According to this year's report, middle-aged people were the most likely age group to be obese, and the rate was higher for Black and Hispanic adults than White and Asian adults. Though obesity rates among adults and youth have not changed significantly in the past couple of years, they remain on the rise. Another recent study revealed that, worldwide, the number of young people ages 5 to 19 who are obese has increased tenfold from 1975 to 2016. Similar findings have been seen among children in the U.S., where the childhood obesity rate nears 20%. The rate of young Americans with obesity has increased 33% from 2000 to 2016. For adults, the rate has increased by about 30%. Plateaus in childhood obesity rates are encouraging and could be related to changes in food and exercise programs at schools, though many of these changes have been inconsistent, experts say. Monitoring obesity prevalence is relevant for public health programs that focus on reducing or preventing obesity, the study authors conclude.
We always rise. California winemakers are determined to rebuild after fires. By Katie Steinmetz, Napa, California. Napa winemaker Clayton Kirchhoff drove down a winding road this week, past singed power lines swinging in the air, and houses that had been reduced to a little more than rubble beside a swimming pool. Farmers on one property counted their sheep to see how many were left. as big silver tankers carted wine out of the area, one of many in California that had been ravaged by fire since Sunday night. Kirchhoff, who lost his home in the flames, was headed for White Rock Vineyards, an estate where grapes have been grown since before Prohibition, and where on Wednesday morning, flames were still licking smoldering tree stumps. Right now, it feels like everything is in slow motion, he says. The recent outbreak of wildfires in California is one of the worst the state has ever seen. As of Thursday, more than 8,000 firefighters were tackling 21 fires, which had already consumed 3,500 structures and led to the death of at least 29 people. Emergency officials worked to evacuate more than 20,000 from their homes, many of them in counties famed for making wine to the north of San Francisco. Several wineries in Napa and Sonoma blazed to the ground. As flames spread, winemakers were forced to leave grapes unpicked at the end of the harvest season and abandon vats of fermenting fruit that they typically tend with great care. Over recent days, responders have struggled to contain fires in the area, and evacuation orders have kept coming. That has left the many people who keep the area's $26 billion wine industry humming, from farmers to tasting room owners, at a loss to assess the damage, even as they prepare to rebuild. It's not what you expect during harvest, says White Rock spokesperson Heather Conlin, to be on the run. The Van den Dries family that has made wines at White Rock Vineyards for the past 40 years says they're thankful everyone in their family is safe. They have also lost a lot. 2 family homes on the property, barns, a chicken coop, a lab and a kitchen, winery equipment, and the main wine library. Crates stacked in front of the wooden doors that guarded examples of every vintage they've ever made caught fire, turning cases of White Rock Chardonnay and Claret into piles of broken glass. With hopes of saving what was left, Kirchhoff was racing to tend surviving wine fermentations, hoping none would spoil and turn into vinegar. He was also reeling from the impact of what had happened. My bed was right in the fire zone, he says. Happily for White Rock, as with many other vineyards, most of the vines look to be in good shape. While many winemaking facilities are just as vulnerable as homes with wooden frames, vineyards themselves can act as excellent firebreaks, says Jennifer Putnam of the Napa Valley Grape Growers Association. There is typically little grass or ground cover to burn underneath the vines, and the plants themselves are full of moisture. Vineyards have saved a lot of homes, she says, and maybe lives too. She still anticipates damage, given that vineyards make up about 10% of the county's acreage. Agricultural officials had deployed to survey the fields in the days after the fire, while others consulted satellite imagery. But no clear picture had emerged. The smoke is so thick, even if you drive up and down, you can't get a grasp of what's been damaged and what hasn't been, says Caleb Mosley, a viticulturist who oversees farming and several vineyards through Michael Wolf Vineyard Services. He says each situation is different in Napa. Some winery owners have plots all over the county. Some have just one. Some have crop insurance that will protect them and power to keep temperatures controlled, even if they're isolated from their land. Some do not. The fires hit after the big push to harvest most grapes, with many estimating that about 80% of the fruit had already been picked. A fire 2 weeks earlier would have been much more devastating for the 2017 vintage, Mosley says. But with valuable Cabernet Sauvignon left on the vines, many growers were making tough decisions about whether to send workers out into the ashy air to pick grapes that might be ruined by smoke taint anyway. How much of the product makes it this year could be literally a million-dollar question for White Rock, Conlin says. And the region is facing much bigger losses, not just from spoiled wine or shriveled grapes, but from losses of tourism income during what is usually a busy time of the year. Some people in Napa and Sonoma lost both their homes and jobs overnight. And as people in the region tried to locate loved ones displaced by the fires, most businesses in downtown Napa had shut their doors on Wednesday. as long lines of people waited near neighborhoods so that emergency responders could escort them into evacuation zones, where they could retrieve medication or pets. Few wandered on normally busy streets. People who had filled trash bags with their possessions tossed them into the trunks of their cars, and many who braved the streets wore masks to protect their lungs. Standing almost anywhere felt like being on the wrong side of a campfire during a windy evening. In one tasting room that was still serving customers, 8 people had sidled up to try local wines. The establishment, Vintners Collective, had been destroyed in an earthquake that rocked the Napa economy 3 years ago. Only a year ago we finally got back on our feet, and this thing happens. It's insane, says owner Garrett Murphy. Groups have been canceling trips and big events planned at his business for a month or more down the line. He worries that air quality concerns might keep people away even longer than the specter of a quake did. Napa will need time to assess the damage of people, the psyche, and the actual economy of the community, he says. But we always rise. The family of White Rock, like many others in the region, sounded similarly defiant notes, saying the region has overcome hell and high water before. Yes, some vintages are probably lost forever, Conlon says, but they're working now to ship out to sell the wine they have already been aging for years, and we're going to get back to work and rebuild as soon as we can. Some visitors were also pushing ahead despite the smoke. One couple at the Vintners Collective Bar had come from Calgary, Alberta for their honeymoon, a region that suffered its own wildfires this summer. Though Joanna and Devin Pipke had second thoughts when they rented a car in San Francisco and found themselves traveling the same direction as all the emergency vehicles, they decided to come to Napa anyway. It's very sensitive for the population, Joanna says. But if someone's going to be open, you want to go and bring them your money. Each time they leave their hotel, they take bottles of water, their phone chargers, and their passports, just in case the fire has reached their inn while they're out. And on Wednesday, they were sipping some Longfellow wines Cabernet. In good times, people want their wine, and in bad times, people want their wine, says Alicia Sylvia, who was serving them in the tasting room. The show must go on. With that, she went over to another couple and popped the cork out of another bottle. Okay, she said. Rosé! The True Story Behind the New Movie About Watergate and Deep Throat by Katie Riley. A new cinematic depiction of Mark Felt, the former associate director of the FBI, better known as the informant Deep Throat, is ringing true with at least one person closely familiar with the story. The film, Mark Felt, the Man Who Brought Down the White House, details how Felt leaked information about the Watergate scandal that ultimately led President Nixon to resign. And Felt's daughter, Joan Felt, said the movie helped her understand him in a new light. I was seeing my dad in a new way and for the first time, really emotionally, feeling and appreciating the pressure that he was under, the strength that he had to call upon in order to handle such a difficult situation, she told Time, recalling how she grew emotional last year watching actor Liam Neeson film a scene as her father, who died in 2008. Now 73, she said she learned the truth about her father's role in the Watergate investigation in increments. Gathering hints in the early 2000s, when he turned away almost every journalist but accepted a visit from Bob Woodward, or when he accidentally slipped into the first person while discussing Deep Throat after watching All the President's Men. But beyond Neeson's characterization of Felt, how does the rest of the movie compare to the real history? Here's where it sticks to reality and where it took some liberties. Fact. Mark Felt leaked to reporters other than the Washington Post, Bob Woodward, and Carl Bernstein. Woodward is briefly featured in the film, which includes a version of the parking garage meeting made famous by All the President's Men. But the film shows Felt meeting more often with Time reporter Sandy Smith, who also covered the Watergate investigation, and whose reporting also contributed to the story. For example, when a senator asked Acting Attorney General Patrick Gray about allegations the FBI had wiretapped journalists, he cited a report in the March 5, 1973 issue of Time. Mark Felt writer and director Peter Landsman said he made the decision not to focus on the better-known reporting work of Woodward and Bernstein so that he could step back from the prevailing Watergate narrative. Watergate is not the story of two reporters, he told Time. Watergate is the story of the system, and when the system broke down, one person had to create a new mechanism. Fact. Mark Felt and his wife traveled to a commune to find their daughter. The Watergate investigation wasn't the only drama going on in Felt's life during the period the film covers. Around the same time, Felt's daughter became involved in a counterculture movement that stood in opposition to the FBI. Though she was not an activist for a group actively monitored by the agency, such as the Weather Underground, Joan Felt confirms that she was a flower child and really did move to a commune, where her parents tracked her down after 3 years of being out of touch. That car coming down the road from up above, down the driveway, coming into relief into our world, was such a shocking moment, she said, recalling the day her parents arrived while she sat in a field holding her infant son. It's a moment I'll never forget. Fiction. But the family reunion didn't play out exactly the way it's shown on screen. My friend and I, the two mothers there with our babies, we were actually naked in the field. So we were horrified that my parents were coming at that particular moment because I knew that my mother especially would be so disapproving. And she was, Joan Felt said. We both jumped up and raced for our residence, which was a reconverted chicken coop, to quickly put on some clothes before my parents could see too clearly what was happening. Fact, Mark Felt was asked during a grand jury interrogation whether he was Deep Throat. The final scene of the Mark Felt movie draws on a real episode that Woodward recounted in his book about Felt, The Secret Man. As Woodward tells it, the story was relayed to him by Justice Department official Stanley Pottinger during a lunch meeting in 1976. Pottinger had noted that at one point during a grand jury investigation about illegal break-ins by FBI agents, Felt volunteered with a smile that he was such a frequent visitor at the White House that some people thought he was Deep Throat. Woodward continued, after Pottinger and the other justice lawyers were finished with their interrogation, Pottinger, as was the custom, asked if any grand jurors who are ordinary citizens had questions for the witness. One man raised his hand and asked, "Were you?" "Was I what?" Felt inquired. "Were you Deep Throat?" Felt looked so stunned, Pottinger said. He seemed to go white. Listening to this over lunch, I probably went white as well. No, Felt initially answered. The film cuts off before Felt answers the question. In reality, Pottinger then told the stenographer to stop taking notes and told Felt that, because he was under oath, he was required to answer honestly. I consider the question to be outside the bounds of our official investigation, so if you prefer, I'll withdraw the question, Pottinger told Felt, who asked that the question be withdrawn. Debatable. Mark Felt brought down the White House. Nixon resigned in 1974 because of public scrutiny over his involvement in the Watergate scandal. But the movie's title, which describes Felt as the man who brought down the White House, has been controversial. Woodward and Bernstein wrote a letter to Landsman last year calling the characterization demonstrably false and saying Felt was only one of several dozen sources they used in their reporting. Felt played a role, at times a courageous one, Woodward told the Associated Press. But this portrait of him as the man who brought down the White House just isn't accurate. But Landsman told Time that he believed Felt's story was the most compelling part of the saga, and that he merits the title by his position at the center of the investigation. I find Felt more interesting because Felt's the one. He wasn't just doing his job, Landsman said. He was sacrificing his own life.
Meet the woman behind Fingerlings, the toy every kid wants right now, by Jennifer Kalfas. When Sidney Wiseman was a kid, she was obsessed with pygmy marmoset monkeys. While she could never have one of the finger-sized animals as a pet, there was another way to own one, as a toy. Years later, as a brand manager at Wowee, a family-run consumer technology company, Wiseman pitched the idea of robotic finger monkeys and worked with the Wowee team to create what later became Fingerlings. A step away from the company's typical products like drones and robotic cars, Fingerlings quickly became a major hit, selling out at stores across the country since it debuted in August. We haven't given it to one child who didn't want to play with it, Wiseman told Money. I don't think we could have anticipated what's going on right now, she added of the toy's success. It's just phenomenal. The Canada-based and family-run company has already sold more than 1 million Fingerlings worldwide and expects demand will only increase as the holiday season approaches. The robotic toys, which cling onto your finger and respond to your touch and voice, can blink their eyes and make noises, similar to the real animal. But monkeys aren't the only Fingerlings. In fact, Wowie went with the less specific name for the product, which was originally going to be called simply Finger Monkeys, to allow for a diverse selection of animals, Wiseman said. Currently, Fingerlings come as monkeys, unicorns, and sloths. And true to their natural form, the sloths are programmed to move slower than the monkeys and unicorns. Right now, the toys are only available at Toys R Us, Amazon, Target, and Walmart, but will soon come to Kohl's and Barnes & Noble. Having a limited number of stores selling Fingerlings, which sell for $14.99, allows Wowie to have better control over the product, Wiseman said. We made sure to limit our partners, she added. Beyond its popularity, Fingerlings present a chance for the company to expand its product line, Wiseman said. The company produces high-priced gadgets geared for robotics lovers, but by taking that technology and placing it in an accessible product, they created a new customer base. The response to this price point is great, Wiseman said. I really think this is going to shape our future development. Creating Fingerlings wasn't just a personal project for Wiseman. It was a family affair. At Wowie, Wiseman works alongside her uncles, Richard and Peter Yanofsky, who are its founders, her mother Gail, and several of her cousins. With the help of her family, Wiseman closely collaborated with Wowie's research and development team to make Fingerlings a reality. It's so cool to think about what you would have wanted to play with while you were young, Wiseman said of her job. You can come up with such different, crazy ideas. And for the pygmy marmoset monkeys that in part inspired the colorful gadgets, they're benefiting from its popularity as well. In its first week of sales in August, Wowie donated $1 from every sale to Wild Aid, an animal conservation nonprofit. Here's how Donna from Parks and Recreation would celebrate Treat Yourself Day in 2017 by Katie Lang. Today is Treat Yourself Day, otherwise known as the best day of the year. For the sad souls who have lived their lives without knowing what this hallowed holiday is until now, here's a brief. On October 13, 2011, Donna Meagel Retta and Tom Haverford, Aziz Ansari, two of the best characters on NBC's Parks and Recreation, introduced Treat Yourself Day to the public. The day is exactly what it sounds like, a day to pamper yourself and indulge in your most extravagant whims. Clothes? Yep. Fragrances? Yep. Massages, mimosas, and fine leather goods? Yes, yes, and yes. The holiday became an instant hit with fans of the show, who have enthusiastically celebrated the day every year since the episode aired. In the last season of the show, Tom and Donna have a final Treat Yourself Day that's their most extravagant yet. In honor of Treat Yourself 2017, we caught up with Retta to see how both she and her on-screen counterpart would celebrate this very important holiday in the present. Why do you think people have loved Donna and Tom doing Treat Yourself Day so much? To me, I feel like Donna and Tom, particularly together, had a childlike love for life, and I think we don't embrace that when we're older. I think watching them do that with sheer abandon, to just enjoy things, kind of brings you back to that, and you want to experience that too. And people love to buy shit. It's a good excuse. Do you still keep in touch with Aziz Ansari since Donna and Tom were partners in crime? The whole cast does. We talk at least once a week, if not more, because we have a group text. Our most recent group text was Pratt saying that he was in town because he's been working so much, so we were trying to figure out where and when. Amy and Nick are both on set for their new show, Making It, so they sent pictures from the barn they were filming at. How do you think Donna would celebrate Treat Yourself Day in 2017? She would do all the things that they said they would do. The massage, the mimosas, the shopping. Once Parks ended and they had that flash-forward episode, she was in a place where she was earning good money, so she would be getting those massages during a trip to Europe, doing more extravagant shopping like in a boutique in Rome. Her Instagram would be filled with more lavish locations. How would you celebrate Treat Yourself Day if you could be as extravagant as Donna? I am an avid handbag purchaser, so my first stop would be Louis Vuitton, Chanel, Gucci. I say this as though I don't do this every other week. I definitely have an obsession with handbags, and I say that it's because they always fit. The clothes that I like, the styles that I like, they may not always make it in my size, but they always make handbags my size.
President Trump is chipping away at Obamacare. Here's what he's doing. By Maya Roden. President Trump took a major step toward upending the Affordable Care Act on Thursday when he signed an executive order he says will help millions of Americans access more affordable insurance plans. While the action was treated as a major accomplishment at the White House, the order Trump signed was light on details. In short, it instructs members of his cabinet to make it easier for consumers to buy short-term insurance plans that don't comply with all of the Affordable Care Act's provisions, while also expanding access to plans offered by trade groups and others. Since I became president of the United States, I just keep hearing repeal and replace, repeal and replace, Trump said. Well, we're starting that process, and we're starting it in a very positive manner. Trump's actions came after months of stalled progress on repealing the Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare, despite the fact that Republicans troll both chambers of Congress. Repeal legislation has been considered at least three times unsuccessfully since Trump took office, leaving the president publicly seething. The order's expansions of so-called association health plans follows legislation that has been proposed by Republican lawmakers in the past. In March, the House of Representatives passed a bill that would allow small businesses to haggle with insurers for better plans. The White House wants to allow for a broader interpretation of an existing law, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, so groups of employers could offer insurance to workers across the country. In banding together, associations could be treated like large groups in the marketplace. Large groups are not required to cover some of the essential benefits mandated under Obamacare, like maternity care, prescriptions, and mental health services, though some offer these protections. The executive order also asks agencies to give employers more flexibility to use health reimbursement arrangements and offer broader access to short-term health insurance plans, which are typically made available to people between jobs and people who miss the enrollment period. These plans also are not required to offer all of the coverage mandated by the Affordable Care Act. Kevin Lucia, the project director at Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute, says taken together the three components of the executive order have the potential to undermine the insurance marketplace. That's because they could push younger and healthier people toward cheaper plans outside of the marketplace, causing premiums to rise for those who choose to stay behind, people who would likely skew older and have more health needs. This appears to be a part of a long chain of events that will have the effect of making the individual market less stable, Lucia tells Time. It's a backdoor way of undermining the Affordable Care Act. The administration has already cut funding for advertisements, and they've reportedly used money that is supposed to help people enrolled to fund anti-ACA campaigns. Democrats were particularly critical of the executive order, including Senator Patty Murray, who is the ranking member of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or HELP. Murray and the Republican chairman of that committee, Senator Lamar Alexander, are currently working on a bipartisan plan to fund Obamacare subsidies and stabilize the insurance markets. Their plan could include options that give states more flexibility under the Affordable Care Act, but the negotiations are still ongoing. The only way to get results for patients and families on health care is to work across the aisle and find common ground, Murray said on Thursday. Republican Senator Rand Paul, who has been a major obstruction to the congressional efforts despite despising Obamacare, stood behind the president as he signed the order at the White House. The Kentucky senator said he worked closely with the Trump administration to craft the order, which he said legalizes choice for the American consumer and opted for Breitbart. This helps you get the hell out of the individual market, Paul told reporters on Thursday afternoon. We're going to let people buy what they want. Joseph Antos, a healthcare scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, says that while some consumers may be attracted to the plan, he believes the idea that it would dramatically change the insurance market is an exaggeration. Because Trump is calling on departments to craft the changes, it will set off a regulatory process and likely elicit strong responses from groups that will be impacted. All of this can't be done easily, Antos says. What we have here is a political statement that says, we did something.
Stranger Things Season 2 is your Halloween binge. Here's What to Know Now by Ashley Hoffman. The wait for Stranger Things Season 2, one of the most anticipated Netflix shows of the year, is almost over. Gather as much chocolate pudding as you can carry because the new season of Stranger Things hits Netflix on October 27th. The Halloween-themed season will continue to evolve the Stranger Things plot from the first season, which left fans with several pressing questions and theories. Just how many episodes of Stranger Things can fans expect? Altogether, Season 2 will consist of 9 new installments. See the titles of the episodes from what co-creators Matt and Ross Duffer have dubbed Stranger Things 2 in a nod to cinematic sequels: Mad Max, The Boy Who Came Back to Life, The Pumpkin Patch, The Palace, The Storm, and The Pollywog. But leave it to Stranger Things to make everything a mystery. It seems as though some of the episode titles may have evolved as a new trailer teases unnamed chapters 7 through 9. They were previously titled The Secret Cabin, The Brain, and The Lost Brother. The whole Stranger Things cast will be back for Season 2. That includes Joyce, Winona Ryder, Hopper, David Harbour, Mike, Finn Wolfhard, Eleven, Millie Bobby Brown, Will, Noah Schnapp, Lucas, Caleb McLaughlin, Dustin, Gaten Matarazzo, Nancy, Natalia Dyer, Steve, Joe Keery, and Jonathan, Charlie Heaton, along with a few newcomers. More on that later. A critical darling, Stranger Things scored 18 Emmy nominations, including one for Outstanding Drama Series, as well as acting nods for Harbour and Brown. Unexpectedly, Shannon Purser, who played the beloved Barb, was also nominated. Stranger Things Season 2 Trailer. The Stranger Things Season 2 trailer opens on everyone's favorite squad at a local arcade playing the adventure video game Dragon's Lair. Will's back from the Upside Down with a serious case of PTSD. Case in point, Will sees a massive arachnid-like monster there to make sure everyone's lives stay nice and high stress. But the biggest revelation? We see Eleven reaching through a wall and into the school, confirming that she'll be back in the Stranger Things mix. Overall, the trailer goes for a spooky vibe. The boys even appear in period-appropriate costumes from Ghostbusters. It bears mentioning that it looks like Dustin is Stan Phillips, Will is Egon Spenger, Lucas is Peter Venkman, and Mike is Winston Zeddemore. Over on the cool side of small-town America, Nancy and Steve reference more 1984 culture touchstones at a Halloween party. See Risky Businesses and Madonna's Material Girl. But midway through the trailer, Vincent Price's famous Thriller voiceover kicks in, and it's clear that something even more horrific than the first season is threatening Hawkins, an inky, new, multi-limbed monster seemingly out to lay waste to the town. More good news? Will says he can feel it everywhere. While the Stranger Things trailer doesn't reveal any of the show's new faces, Netflix announced that there's a new family in town. Billy, Doc Ray Montgomery, is the brother of tough skater girl Max, Sadie Sink, who befriends Dustin and Lucas. As for Billy, he doesn't exactly make friends. Also of note, Paul Reiser will play Dr. Owens, who's likely the guy conducting tests on Will. Brett Gelman will play disgraced journalist Murray Bauman, who should fit right in with his conspiracy theorist tendencies. And Sean Astin will play Joyce's new man, Bob. Stranger Things characters, then and now. The show begins right before Halloween in 1984, nearly 1 year after the first installment. Last we left the Stranger Things characters, Eleven had destroyed the Stranger Things monster with her mind and simultaneously disintegrated. Good news, she's still out there somewhere. And in the final moments, we saw Will cough up a slug in front of the bathroom mirror, suggesting the Upside Down was still in his system and potentially the Hawkins sewer system, which should bode well for everyone. In the aftermath of Season 1, Will's getting routine brain tests, which people are closely monitoring. He also seems to be in touch with the bigger, badder monster more than the others, proclaiming it isn't after him, but it does want everyone else. Let's check in on the others. Joyce is dating her old high school classmate Bob, played by Sean Astin, who starred in 1985's The Goonies, which inspired the show. Officially, Hopper is trying to cover up all the disaster from Season 1, but he's still on the hunt for the truth. "Whatever's happening is spreading from this place," he declares in the trailer. We also hear Mike say to Eleven, "If you're out there, just please give me a sign." It looks like he's about to get one. Nancy misses Barb, poor Barb, and everyone else whose life she's touched. Stranger Things Season 2 Theories. One popular Stranger Things theory is that the Upside Down is just a friendly dimension that's a portal to another, much worse dimension. Also of note, Eleven seems pretty casual when she's reaching through the wall, meaning perhaps she's in a sort of limbo that isn't as perilous as what's coming for everyone now. Stranger Things Season 3 and 4, coming soon? There might be three more Stranger Things seasons coming after the conclusion of Season 2. We're thinking it will be a four-season thing and then out, co-creator Russ Duffer told New York Magazine in August. At that point, it seemed fans would have to find another way to experience joy in life, but in September, producer Sean Levy told Entertainment Weekly they might feed the frenzy with five seasons. The truth is, we're definitely going four seasons, and there's very much the possibility of a fifth. Beyond that, it becomes, I think, very unlikely.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.